Chapter 6. The grief and anxiety didn't die away, but of necessity they receded. And as the Bellona worked her way tack upon tack round the Saints to regain the bay at dawn, the top of his mind was taken up with the handling of the ship and with a very close watch to see just what harm the lax but harsh command of his jobbing captain had done. He'd already looked through the recent gunnery records, which contained no account whatsoever of live firing, only of rattling the great guns in and out. The log, on the other hand, spoke of frequent flogging, more punishment than Jack would have inflicted in a quarter. At one bell in the morning watch, the Bellona's tender, the Ringle, now commanded by that valuable young man Reed, a fast, weatherly, sweet-sailing schooner with much less draught than the great 74, hailed to say that she was shoaling her water. 10 fathoms, then 9. "What you say, Jan?" asked Jack. The pilot was standing at his side. "What him bottom?" "Arm your lead," called Jack. And shortly after, the reply came back across the calm, gently heaving sea. "Hake's teeth and white sand, if you please, sir."
"Carry on, sir," said Jan. "Next cast, 10, 11, 12.
A presence behind him, and a very agreeable smell. "Which I thought you might like some coffee, sir," said Killick, passing the mug. "The doctor said it preserved the frame from falling damps."
"Bellona," called the tender. 9 fathoms, if you please."
A pause.
10 and grey sludge."
Jan nodded with satisfaction. "If we carry on till come 2 bells and then worship and stand east-south-east and half-east, we fine. We all right, sir." At 2 bells the idlers were called. The sentinels all round the ship cried, "All's well." The mate of the watch, having heaved the log, reported to Miller, third lieutenant and officer of the watch, 4 knots exactly, sir, if you please." And this he wrote on the logboard, together with the Bellona's present course of south-south-west. The hoarser of the carpenter's mates whispered, 4.5 inches in the well, sir," into Miller's ear. And Miller, turning to the captain and taking off his hat, repeated all this to him in a voice calculated to be heard above the din of hand-pumps, buckets, swabs, and holy stones of various sizes that were preparing to clean the deck in the first half-lights of the coming day. But before they could begin, Jack called, "Belay there!" And more gently, "Mr. Miller, we will wear ship, if you please, and stand east, south-east, and half-east. The watch will suffice." Jack rarely tacked a line of battleship when he had sea room to wear her, letting her head fall off from the wind and come right round to the desired bearing. It was slower and less spectacular than coming up into the wind's eye, crossing through and steadying on the new course, but it called for fewer hands, and it preserved both spars and rigging. He now watched the manoeuvre attentively. It was carried out smoothly. Not very fast, but smoothly, with no bellowing or damming of eyes. And when the quartermaster at the con, seeing the compass dead on the true bearing, called to the helmsman, "Thus, thus, very well, thus," Jack went below, reasonably satisfied, but still low in his spirits. He hated to think of Stephen wandering about there on a hostile shore, among so many more or less trustworthy foreigners. He sat there, reflecting, while the series of bells that had accompanied his life at sea for so many years continued their unchanging pace, bringing up hammocks with a fine rush of feet at the 7th set of strokes, and news of breakfast at the 8th. Almost the only advantage of being on the Brest blockade was that the victuals were usually fresh and plentiful, and breakfast, perhaps Jack's favourite meal apart from dinner, was fairly sure of being able to provide capital sausages and bacon, while the hens, and the Bellona was unusually well found in poultry, being still in something like their native air, gave almost a superfluity of eggs. Yet this was a lonely breakfast. Obviously, in the nature of things,
the captain of a man-of-war, above all, one who couldn't afford to keep a table, and this was Jack's case at present, must eat many and many a solitary meal. But for a great while Jack Aubrey had sailed with Stephen Maturin, and now he missed his companion quite severely. A wholly human and often contradictory companion, essentially different from the only other guests he could invite, lieutenants, master's mates, or midshipmen, who were all debarred by custom and by common prudence from disagreeing with the skipper on any point whatsoever, and who in any case were not to speak until they'd been spoken to. "Come in," he called. "Sir," said a midshipman, opening the cabin door, "Mr. Summers' compliments and duty, and the Alexandria is in sight." "Thank you, Mr. Weatherby. Is she within signalling distance?"
"Oh, sir, I'm sure I can't tell," said Weatherby, aghast. He was a first voyager. "Shall I run up and ask?"
"Never trouble. I shall be on deck directly." "She might conceivably be bringing us our post," reflected Jack. "How I should love a fat parcel of letters, news of the girls, word of the village and that reptile Griffiths, and perhaps the proceedings will be out." He'd combined his last visit to London but one to criticise the naval estimates in the Commons as member for Millport, and to reading a second paper on the precession of the equinoxes to the Royal Society as a fellow of that august and learned body. For he was a late-blooming but quite highly esteemed mathematician, specialising in the problems of celestial navigation. Uncommon mathematical and musical abilities are quite often to be found in men wholly ignorant of the laws of prosody and barely capable of assembling 20 words of prose in a passably elegant, coherent and grammatical form. "And there might even be an encouraging letter from Lawrence," he went on. But the word "letter" reminded him of the shockingly painful one to the Reverend Mr. Gagan that he must write out fair. He could scarcely ask his clerk to do so, in order that it should go to the flag as soon as possible. And to change the current of his mind, he swallowed the last of his coffee and walked forward along the quarter-deck, all its inhabitants silently moving over to the larboard side as he appeared.
"Where away?" he asked. 2 points on the starboard bow, sir," said Summers, the officer of the watch. And two of the midshipmen exchanged a knowing look, for most of the people could see her perfectly well. It was fully day now, though the sun was still hidden by cloud low over the distant land, and there was mist over the sea itself. And presently Jack, bringing his good eye to bear with a now habitual twist of his neck, made out the little frigate, her sails whiter than the whiteness between the two ships.
"She's heading for the Black Rocks," said Jack. "Has she uttered?"
"She dipped a topsail, sir," said Summers, "but that was probably just Captain Naismith's fun."
"Give her a waft," said Jack, who was much senior to Naismith, the frigate's commander, "and throw out desire to speak to you."
The signal midshipman, an oldster named Callow, who had sailed with Jack before, and the yeoman were expecting this, and the signal raced up, breaking out directly. The Alexandria put before the wind, spread stunsails, and began throwing a bow wave, most creditable in this moderate breeze.
"Say, dice, come no higher," called Jack. "Then, have you any news, any letters?"
A short pause, in which all the telescopes on the Bellona's quarterdeck focused earnestly upon the frigate. And even before Callow could read out the answer, an audible sigh arose from the quicker-minded watchers.
"No news, sir. No letters. Regret. Repeat, regret. Reply, many thanks, the Lord will provide. Carry on."
The Alexandria carried on, vanishing entirely within half an hour as their courses diverged, Jack beating up for his usual station at this time of day of Dinant Point, where he might possibly fall in with the Ramillies coming down from St. Matthew's,
or one of the cutters that plied between the squadrons. But for the time being, he was to attend to the young gentleman. They were gathering there on the quarter-deck behind him, accompanied by the schoolmaster, and although some were furtively giggling, treading on one another's toes, most were decently apprehensive. "Very well, gentlemen, let's begin," said Jack, in their direction, and he led the way into the fore cabin. Here they showed up their day's workings, which, as there'd been no noon observation the day before, were necessarily the product of dead reckoning, and they differed little, except in neatness. Both Walkinshaw and Jack were perfectly at home with the mathematics of navigation, and it was difficult for either to understand how very deeply ignorant it was possible for the young and feather-brained to be, particularly those young men who'd spent most of their school time ashore learning Latin, and in some cases Greek, and even a little Hebrew, possibly some French. This occurred to Jack with some force in the silence that followed his commendation of the neat and his giving back the workings. And out of this silence he said to a dwarfish 12-year-old, the son of one of his former lieutenants, "Mr. Thompson, what is meant by a sign?" He glanced round the general blankness and went on, "Each of you take a piece of paper and write down what is meant by a sign. Mr. Weller," this to a boy who had been to a nautical academy at Wapping, "you're whispering to your neighbour. Jump up to the masthead and stay there until you're told to come down. But before you go, gather the papers and show them to me." It was difficult to tell whether the schoolmaster or his pupils felt the more distressed, as the captain looked through the undeniable proof of such very complete ignorance of the first elements. "Very well," he said at last, "we shall have to start again with the ABC. Pass the word for my joiner." The joiner appeared, brushing chips from his apron. "Hemmings," said Jack, "run me up a blackboard, will you? A flat, dead paint that'll take chalk handsomely, and let me have it by this time tomorrow." To the youngsters he said, "I shall write definitions and draw diagrams, and you'll get them by heart." He was not in the best of moods, and his absolute determination, together with his bulk and his immense authority on board, was singularly impressive. They filed out in silence, looking grave. The next morning the blackboard was present, fixed by thumbscrews within easy reach of the captain's hand, and from it the boys were taught, with words and diagrams, the nature of sine, cosine, tangent, cotangent, secant and cosecant, the relations between them, and their value in helping to find your position in a prodigious ocean, no shore, no landmark for 10,000 miles. All these things were to be found in Robinson's Elements of Navigation, which, together with the requisite tables and nautical almanac, lay in their sea chests, a necessary part of their equipment. And Mr. Walkinshaw had tried to lead the youngsters through them, but nothing came anywhere near the concentrated, forceful instructions of Jove himself. And after what seemed an anxious eternity to the midshipman's berth, but which in fact lasted no more than a few of the Bellona's usual patrols from Duanene Bay to the Black Rocks, in hazy, sometimes foggy weather, in which they saw nothing at all, and sometimes with such light airs that on occasion they lacked even steerage way, and the captain had all the time in the world for trigonometry. Yet Thursday came at last. A blessed Thursday. A make-and-mend day when the mist cleared. A decent breeze blew from the northeast, and the youngsters sat in the sun on the forecastle with their sea-daddies showing them how to darn their stockings, or mend torn clothes, or tie the simple knots and learn the elements of splicing. A Thursday on which the lookout at the masthead hailed, "On deck there! A ship's topsails right to leeward!" Presently, most of those who felt they could be spared below were aloft with telescopes. And after a while it was found that she was the Ramillies, now lying to and presumably watching some suspect sail northwards along the Passage du Fort, out of sight from the Bellona. No sooner was this agreed to by all than a second vessel was seen, a cutter coming from the direction of Ushant, beyond the Black Rocks, and then even a third, the heavy frigate Doris. After such loneliness, the bay seemed positively crowded. The Ramillies was a right welcome sight to all hands, and particularly to Jack. Their captain, Billy Fanshawe, was an old friend of his. So indeed was the Doris. But what really delighted every man aboard, including those who could neither read nor write, was the identification of the cutter as one belonging to the flagship and employed for distribution of the mail throughout the squadron under Admiral Stranraer's command. The Doris, out in the offing, had altered course to intercept the cutter well before the Bellona and she had her letters first, although Harding, who'd left his wife expecting her first child, spread an unreasonable amount of canvas. Yet quite soon the Bellona's grim, discontented looks gave way to tense and happy anticipation. The cutter came neatly alongside, seized the net dangling from the whip to the mainyard, put a fine round mail sack into it, and sped off towards the distant Ramillies. The sack was carried hotfoot to the great cabin, where Jack, the first lieutenant, and the clerk sorted it. From the cabin it filtered down first to the wardroom, then by way of the clerk to the warrant officers and petty officers, and then by way of the midshipmen to the ratings of their particular divisions. Jack's mail obviously stayed where it was, and as soon as the cabin door had closed behind Harding and the clerk, he seized the first on the pile, a letter addressed, and badly addressed, in that most familiar of hands. They'd parted on indifferent terms, and he opened it with the liveliest expectation of all their affection being fully restored, smiling as he did so. The letter was dated from Woolcombe on the 14th. With these northerly winds, it had taken no more than 5 days. Mr. Aubrey, it is with a deepest, the very deepest concern, that I must tell you I have been shown unanswerable proof of your infidelity. In open contempt of your promise before God's altar, you lay with a woman called Amanda Smith in Canada and got her with child. Deny it if you can. I have the proofs, and I mean to take advice. In the meantime, I shall give the Admiral notice to leave my house at Ashgrove and return there with the children. Then came some tear-blotted and scratched-out lines. The obviously composed and recopied letter now abandoned its original and improvised, grew far less coherent, far less legible. He just made out the words, "You left her bed and came into mine," when he was called on deck. "Sir," said Harding, "you asked me to tell you if Ramillies gave any sign of life. This last minute she's thrown out our number and Captain Repair aboard. I've acknowledged and given word to ready your barge." "Thank you, Mr. Harding," said Jack. "Make all suitable sail, if you please." He returned to the cabin, and having sat for a while, he reached out for the other letter from Sophie and opened it with a hesitant, almost trembling hand. The date was a week before that which he'd just read, the writing more wholly familiar. "My dearest Jack, how sorry I am to have sent you off so shabbily, and for a great while I've been meaning to beg pardon for my bad temper, trying to tell you how even a most loving heart, a female heart, can be affected by the ill-humoured moon. But these things are very hard for a sadly ignorant creature to set down on paper so that the words give any real picture of her feelings, and before I'd written anything but odd headings such as love and kisses and forgiveness, a letter came from Bath with the most frightful news. You'll certainly remember that Mama lived with a friend called Mrs. Morris, the Honourable Mrs. Morris, who helped her with the business, and that they had a man-servant, a worthless fellow we all disliked when they lived here, particularly your seaman. But he was useful in the business because he understood horse racing and the laying of odds. Well, Mrs. Morris has run off with him, apparently taking all the money and anything else they could carry, and when Mama heard they were married, legally married, in a church, she fell down senseless and had to be bled, and she's had fits ever since, laughing and crying. With dear Diana's help, I brought her back here. She'd almost destroyed their apartment in Pulteney Street, and anyhow she wasn't fit to live there alone. The servants, apart from old Molly, had all left, and I'm afraid she behaved dreadfully in the coach. And since the girls are back from school, bringing friends with them, the little Nugent children, I've had to put her in your study, so near the necessary room. But do not fear. We've put a bed in the left-hand corner with a wardrobe and a chest of drawers behind it. I cannot tell you how kind dear Mrs. Oakes has been. And she will never come near your precious ship models or surveying instruments. When you come on leave, and oh, may it be soon, my love, and when the holiday girls and their friends are gone, we will move her upstairs, or possibly back to Bath with a much more suitable companion. She says there's a clergyman who is on the brink of making her an offer. Dear Jack, please do not worry about having money sent to me for housekeeping. We're very well with what comes from the farm, the dairy, the kitchen garden, and my poultry yard. But even if it were not for them, Diana absolutely insists on giving us a very handsome rent for her wing of the house and the stabling. Such stabling now, such horses. With the help of the gentleman who lent her the coach, she took you and Stephen down in, she has it yet, she pawned that enormous great blue diamond she brought back with her from America. "Be damned to living on £200 a year," she cried, "and is launching into breeding Arabs again. And although that sad place at Barham's not yet sold, she's taken all Mears pasture for them. She said it was absurd to keep the Blue Peter, as they call it, hidden away in a jeweller's case. She couldn't wear it at our Dorchester assemblies, only in London or Paris. And in any case, she'd soon have it again once Stephen's affairs were in order. She looks forward extremely to a coach and six." Jack laid the paper down, and in a dull, heavy way he wondered how he had come to be so deeply foolish as to leave Amanda's letters in a square cardboard box among his official and business correspondence. A certain liking, a certain gratitude had prevented him from balling them up and throwing them away. There would have been an indecency in doing so, in spite of her extreme silliness. He felt no particular guilt except for this foolishness. By his code, a man who was directly challenged must, in honesty, engage. Anything else would be intolerably insulting. Yet had he known of this miserable old woman's prying and her malice, he would certainly have played the scrub in Canada. He reflected on Sophie's general attitude towards these matters. Her extreme disapproval of any irregularity, any levity in speaking, of even a looseness that reached nowhere near as far as criminal conversation. For her looseness in conversation was criminal, almost in the lawyer's sense of the term. "Sir," said his first lieutenant, "forgive me for bursting in on you, but your barge is lowering down. And, sir, may I tell you, Eleanor and I have a daughter. Healthy, pink and cheerful. Give you joy of her with all my heart, William," said Jack, crushing his hand. "And Mrs. Harding, too, of course. I'm sure that she'll turn out to be a good un." The ceremony of the side, and the captain of the Bellona, preceded by a midshipman, stepped into the boat. Bondon shoved off. The bargemen gave way, pulling a fine even stroke across the 50 yards to the Ramillies. The ceremony of the side again. Captain Aubrey piped aboard and kindly greeted by Captain Fanshawe, his senior by a short neck, who led him into the cabin, placed a glass of brandy in his hand, and with a curiously embarrassed air said, "Well, Jack, I hope you had an agreeable post." "Not quite what I could have wished as far as I've looked," said Jack. "But perhaps something better may appear. How was yours?" "A charming letter from Dolly, and quite good news of the children. The rest was mostly bills. But, Jack, I'm truly sorry to say the cutter also brought me an order from the flag. I am required to acquaint you that on the night you received a pilot from Ramillies and shaped a course for the Ras du Seine, two French frigates sailed from Brest with the wind at nor'east and are now attacking British and Allied merchantmen with great success. This cannot but be attributed to your negligence in not keeping a good lookout, since from all appearance the Frenchmen must have crossed your wake. I am therefore to reprimand you severely, and you are hereby severely reprimanded. Yes, sir, said Jack without expression. Is that all? No, replied Fanshawe, with more expression than he intended, and with his eyes on the paper in front of him. I am also under orders to require you to proceed off Ushant without the loss of a moment and to report to the flag. There you will be attached to the offshore squadron, where it's hoped that other and perhaps sharper eyes will diminish the very grave consequences of such unseemly negligence. A silence. Neither intended to comment on the Admiral's prose. "Will you dine with me, Jack?" asked Fanshawe in an attempt at an ordinary conversational tone. "Thank you very much, Billy," said Jack, "but without the loss of a moment stands in the way. And between ourselves, my post acquainted me that I've been taken in adultery without a goddamn leg to stand on and that there's the devil to pay. It destroys a man's appetite, you know." "Oh, my dear Jack, I know!" cried Fanshawe with great feeling. "I know only too well. Come, drink up your brandy and I'll see you over the side." Coming aboard the Bellona again, Jack returned the many salutes, walked into his cabin where the letters were still strewn over a medley of unopened covers, and sent for the master. "Mr. Woodbine," he said, "pray shape a course for Ushant, for wherever the offshore squadron is most likely to be lying at this state of the tide and in the particular wind, or whatever wind we find out there. Indeed, the winds the offshore squadron experienced were generally very much harder than those that blew eastward of Ushant, especially the great sou'westers, from whose full force and from whose prodigious seas the inshore ships were protected to some degree by the chain of the Saints, which acted as a not very efficient but still appreciable breakwater. And this was even more evident in the Chenal de la Helle, which Woodbine took that afternoon. They made good progress, and although the topsails had to be double-reefed on reaching the wholly unprotected Passage de Fromvoort, it was clear that the wind was diminishing. On the other hand, the monstrous sea it had worked up on the far side of the island was, if anything, greater still, in spite of the heavy rain by the time they reached the squadron, lying to off the stiff bay in the northeast. And when Jack, in response to the flagship's captain, repair aboard, made his way down into his wildly heaving barge, he missed his footing for once, and with his boat cloak flying about his ears, he fell plump into the water swirling about the boat's bottom. Much more water joined it on the way across, and it was a damp Jack Aubrey that stood waiting for his interview with the Admiral aboard the Charlotte. A long wait. And although Charles Morton, her captain, was civil enough, Jack knew perfectly well that a man who was very much out of favour, who had just received a reprimand, a severe reprimand, was a dangerously infectious leper, above all in a ship governed by Stranraer, and he inflicted neither his remarks nor his presence on any of the officers about him. When he was taken into the Admiral's cabin, he found that the captain of the fleet was also present, sitting at Stranraer's side behind a long table set athwartship with the Admiral's secretary and a clerk at the larboard end. "Good evening, my lord," he said.
"Good evening, sir."
"Good evening, Captain Aubrey," said the Admiral. "Sit down. Now, what have you to say about these French frigates you allowed to slip past you?"
"I have only to say that I very much regret any Frenchman should have got out of Brest."
"Then you admit they went by?" "I must have expressed myself badly, my lord. I expressed nothing but regret at what is said to have taken place. I acknowledge no sort of responsibility."
Where was your ship at sunset on the 27th?
2 cables north of the Mangla, my lord, waiting for the tide.
Then how do you explain the fact that 2 frigates could leave the Goulet de Brest, run out by the Eloise, and be seen a league north of the Ile de Seine 3/4 of an hour later, without they passed astern of you, almost within hail, certainly in sight?
I do not explain it at all, my lord. But I will assert that there was a lookout at each masthead, and of course on the forecastle, able seamen of known reliability.
So you deny the possibility of the Frenchman's getting past unseen?
I do not deny it. The weather was uncommon thick at times that afternoon and night. The pilot had to feel his way along past the Bassier by the flash of surf. And it's not impossible that she passed unseen. What I do deny is the possibility of her doing so through the fault or negligence of any of my people.
So you blame it all on the weather, do you?
If blame there should be, I should certainly lay it on the fog, my lord. The Admiral looked at Calvert, the captain of the fleet, and the officer principally concerned with discipline. What do you say? Calvert, a cold, withdrawn man, tall for a sailor and thin, looked dispassionately at Jack for a moment and said, "In cases of this kind, there's much to be said for gathering all the available objective evidence. Not only does the ship in question keep a logbook with remarks on the weather, but there are also the officers' and midshipmen's journals. If there should ever become an important disciplinary matter, if there should be the least question of anyone asking for a court-martial, they would certainly have to be looked at." Stranraer considered. The clerk mended his pen.
"Oh, I don't think it'll come to that," said the Admiral at last. "If Captain Aubrey will solemnly declare that his ship was in a state of full preparedness on the 27th, I shall rest content."
Jack made the declaration.
Stranraer stood up, saying, "Then let's leave it at that."
"Certainly, my lord. But if you'll allow me, I have a request to make. A request for leave."
"Leave?" cried Stranraer. "Not more leave, for God's sake. Parliamentary leave again."
"No, my lord, for urgent private affairs."
"No, that really will not do. If every officer or seaman, for that matter, were to go home every time there was an urgency in his private affairs, we should never be able to man the fleet. It's not a sudden death, I trust."
"No, my lord."
"Then let's hear no more about it. Ours is a hard service, as you know very well, and this is wartime."
Certainly it was a hard service. And neither Admiral Stranraer nor the autumnal gales had the least intention of making it any less so. The squadron was drilled, and most rigorously drilled, in all weathers short of a close-reefed topsail blow. Towards the end of the day, boats would be seen carrying apprehensive captains across to the flag to hear the Admiral's candid opinion of their seamanship. His notion of drill was curious, rather like that of the army of an earlier age, when precision of button, pipe clay and movement counted for almost everything, together with evolutions such as countermarches, which had very little to do with war, an activity that might easily spoil a uniform. Lord Stranraer had little use for gunfire. He would certainly have grappled with the French had they come out, but during his very frequent drills the great guns generally lay idle, shining wherever polish was in any way appropriate, and housed with perfect regularity. It was something like the West Indian discipline transported to the Channel, where it made even less sense than it had in the Caribbean. Although he was constantly forming and reforming the line of battle, with the rear becoming the van and the van becoming the rear, combat itself didn't really seem to interest the Admiral. He had in his youth been concerned in a certain number of actions in which he'd not behaved with discredit, but he pinned all his faith in the moral force of a large, intact fleet, impeccably expert in all possible manoeuvres, and professionally far in advance of any possible rival, a body that would silently impose its will. However, these drills did at least keep Jack Aubrey very fully occupied indeed.
He was extremely unwilling to have his ship, and, by inference, his ship's company, picked out for harsh signals. Bellona's number showing clear aboard the flag or the repeating frigate, followed by "Keep your station," or "Make more sail," or some telegraphic remark such as "Look alive," or "Do you need assistance?" And since Bellona's crew, though a very fair body for the purpose of fighting the ship, at present included more than a fair share of landmen, and, which was even more important, had never at any time been worked up to this kind of stopwatch performance in anything but gunnery, he and his officers had to do their very utmost to anticipate the next order. A wearing task, and one in which they weren't always successful. The Bellona's barge, therefore, often joined those who were summoned aboard the flag at the end of the exercise to be told their faults by their rough-tongued admiral. Jack didn't enjoy these sessions, but they didn't touch him deeply, even when the strictures were deserved, which, with such a crew as his, was sometimes inevitable, because his mind was in a very curious state of hurry, confusion, and distress. Except when it was taken up with the day-long task of making his ship give as good an account of herself in a highly competitive series of operations, often in heavy weather, his mind ran on that letter and on the stranger who'd written it. Innumerable possibilities came crowding, and an immense sadness alternated with a perhaps still greater frustration, which took the form of a longing for battle. This was clearly obvious to those that knew him well, and even the captain of the fleet, not an exceptionally percipient man, handled him with care aboard the Charlotte. On his own quarterdeck he awarded no punishment. There was little need, but occasionally he'd clap his jaw shut on some intended rebuke, and this had an effect far more marked than any blasphemous roar. "I hope to God he don't explode," said anxious, unhappy Killick. "God help the poor bugger he explodes upon," said Bondon. Solution, or at all events relief, through the very great and varied emotion of battle, came in sight on a Monday. The day before, Bellona, like all the other ships and vessels in the squadron, had rigged church. Jack Aubrey could hardly have been called a religious man, but as well as his many superstitions, he also had his pieties. He revered the sound, if not the full implication, of the Book of Common Prayer, the lessons, and the usual psalms and readings. The other rituals, such as the inspection of the entire ship and every soul aboard her, clean, shaved, sober, and towing a given line, or rather seam, soothed his mind. And although today he didn't feel up to reading a sermon, he and all his people were perfectly satisfied with the even more usual articles of war, which, through immemorial use, had acquired ecclesiastical qualities of their own. It is true that there were obvious and extremely painful associations with the parish church at Woolcombe, but the great heave of the sea, the creak of the rigging and the smell of tar put a great enough distance between the two, and it was not until he'd returned to his cabin that an unlucky shifting of some papers to make room for his prayer book showed him Sophie's letter clear, and the sense of desolation, fury, and extreme distress returned with even greater force. Jack Aubrey was on deck this Monday morning, having sent his breakfast away, 4 eggs untouched congealing in their butter, and he saw the Admiral's signal. The Charlotte was a talkative ship, and although this was usually thought a tiresome characteristic, it did give the signal officers a great deal of practice, and now he heard Callow read off the hoists almost as they appeared without referring to the book. The squadron was to proceed in line abreast on a west-south-westerly course under all plain sail, the Bellona at the southern tip. Yet the glass was dropping. The southern sky, or as much of it as could be seen under the low cloud, was wanting in promise. and the sea of this ebbing tide had some curious pallid streaks apparently rising from the depths. The first lieutenant and the master looked grave. Harding had dined with the Charlotte's wardroom the day before, and he'd learnt that this sweep was being carried out, primarily in order to find how fast and how accurately a signal could travel from one extremity of the line, the unusually widespread line, to the other and back again. Lord Stranraer had another admiral, an expert on signals, aboard as a guest. Presently they were all underway, and the line, after a great deal of nagging from the flag, was as straight on the surface of the ocean as the earth's curvature would allow. But this perfection didn't last. A little before dinner, the Charlotte made the signal for the squadron to tack together, emphasised by a gun, and as far as could be seen, it was obeyed with tolerable regularity right across the broad front, though a second gun seemed to show that at least one ship on the far eastern end had been slow, or had even missed the signal altogether. There was a good deal of murk over there. Another explanation was that the unknown ship, having already mixed its noonday grog, was so infuriated by this untimely order that it delayed out of mere bloody-mindedness. Having come about, the squadron made a fair board, quite time enough to eat their quarter of a pound of cheese. This was a banyan day, and then returned to the former course, though with a little more west in it. Easy sailing. But presently the weather thickened, and the sound of the wind in the rigging rose steadily until it had traversed a full octave. Jack called for preventer stays. "We shall soon be going home," said Harding to Miller, who now had the watch. And by home he meant that dismal stretch of sea off Keller's Island where the Admiral liked to shelter, when the sea, wind and rain threatened to become more outrageous than usual. "Reef topsails, Mr. Miller, if you please," said Jack. The t'gallants had disappeared long since, and even the Ringle, as trim as a duck away there to leeward, showed little more than a handkerchief on each mast and a third right forward. "Hands reef topsails," came the cry, and the sharp, cutting bosun's pipe. And as the men raced aloft, Jack, gazing over the larboard bow, caught hints of whiteness away down in the troubled grey, the growing sea, and its now much wilder crests. "Port your helm," he said quietly to Compton, the older of the two men at the wheel, a hand who knew him well and the tone of his voice. Compton and his mate eased the great plunging ship a trifle to starboard, opening Jack a view as he stood there swaying to the sea, the telescope to his good eye. A long pause, an electric tension on the quarter-deck, and right along the waist of the ship, filled with men who knew or knew of him. Then the first of a series of blinding squalls of mixed rain, sleet and snow. And when it had passed, Callow said hesitantly, "Sir, I believe I saw Monmouth repeat tack all together just before she vanished." Jack and his officers stared briefly eastward. "I see nothing," he said. "Did you make out any signal, Mr. Harding?" "None, sir." "Mr. Callow, make enemy in sight 2 leagues southwest by south heading northwest. Mr. Miller, shake out the reefs in the foretopsail. Serve 4 topmast staysail half in." He stepped over to the wheel, and with his eye on those remote flecks in the infinity of other greys and whiteness, all shifting incessantly, he set a course to intercept the vessel, the enemy, the very probable enemy. The ship's company, including those who had escaped from the sick berth along with their attendants, lined the side. If there were any so morose as to disbelieve the captain's implied declaration, they didn't mention it. From his early days as an astonishingly successful frigate captain, coming home with a tale of captured ships and a fortune in prize money, Jack had acquired the status of a mythical being, or something very like it, a being whose judgment in these matters couldn't be wrong, and any scepticism would have been most furiously resented. The event confirmed the believers in their creed. Within half an hour, the chase, raised high on a towering wave, was seen to be a frigate wearing French colours, herself pursuing a merchantman. She was not a national ship, however, but one of those powerful fast-sailing privateers from Vannes or Lorient that were more deadly as commerce raiders than the regular men of war, and that were now making the most of what war was left to them, often running very extreme risks within miles of the Channel fleet. She was called Les Deux Frères, and so intent was she on her prey, already within long shot, but they far preferred boarding in case a ball causing a leak should spoil the cargo, that she didn't make out the Bellona, partly veiled in a squall for some minutes. On doing so, she instantly bore up, bringing the wind not right aft but on her quarter, her best point of sailing. At the same time, out of mere spite, she fired at the merchantman and almost immediately set her flying jib. Little good did either do. The shot missed and the sail blew out of its boat rope. Still, she fled along, throwing a splendid bow wave, her heavy crew tending the sail with the utmost attention and risking long shots at the 74 in the hope of wounding her sails and cutting up her rigging, conceivably knocking away a yard or a topmast. After all, the Deux Frères carried a by no means contemptible armament, including some carronades. But even more than that, every man and boy aboard knew that their last three captures in the chops of the Channel had made them the richest privateer afloat. She fled with the utmost zeal, therefore, almost as fast as the Ringle steadily there on her starboard bow just out of shot. She fled with all the earnest desire to preserve wealth and freedom that can be imagined, and with almost superhuman skill. But short of the Bellona being struck by lightning, a good deal was flashing above the low cloud cover, she had no chance. For the sea was rising. Minute by minute the crests were higher, the spume tearing away from their tops, and the hollows between them were deeper and wider. And in seas of this magnitude, no frigate could outsail a well-handled ship of the line to windward of her, since in these deep valleys the frigate was becalmed, while the 74, which in any case could spread more sail, was not, or not entirely, and she retained the momentum of her 1,600 tons. "It's going to be a dirty night," said Jack to the officer of the watch. "Pray pass the word for the gunner." "Master Gunner," he went on, "will not touch the lower deck port lids, but it would be as well to ready the forward larboard 18-pounders. You drew them all yesterday, I believe?"
"So I did, sir."
"And you're quite happy about your tompions with all this wet about?"
"If any misses fire, sir,"
said the gunner, his rain-soaked old face grinning with delighted anticipation, "you may call me Jack Pudding." Then, the full horror of this remark striking home, he looked perfectly blank, his lips framing unspoken words. All conversation, all possible explanations were cut off by a freakish sea flooding green over the quarterdeck rail and surging aft. And before it had cleared, an even more freakish carronade ball from the Deux Frères struck and shattered the Bellona's wheel, flinging the helmsman right and left unhurt. She put straight before the wind and offered to come up the other side, taken all aback. But she had right seamen aboard, and they, brailing up the mizzen topsail and starting the mainsheet, quickly brought her under control until the usual purchases to the tiller had been shipped, allowed the ship to be steered by orders called down to the hands on either side of the sweep. In the few minutes that all this took, the Deux Frères forged ahead. But when they saw the Bellona filled and squared away with her upper deck ports open and the guns ran out, their hearts died within them. They abandoned the notion of crossing the Bellona's bows and raking her with all they could throw, abandoned it entirely, came up into the wind, struck her colours, and lay to. Jack edged the Bellona over to make something of a lee, sent the Ringle and the Blue Cutter with a well-armed prize crew aboard under Miller, telling him to make for Falmouth and send the frigate's master back with his officers and papers. "And be uncommon brisk, Mr. Miller. It'll be nip and tuck getting the boat aboard." Nip and tuck it was, with the wind increasing to such a shocking degree, and it took the whole of the afternoon to heave the cutter in. But at last it was done, and the boat made triply fast. Well before that, however, the Frenchman had been taken disconsolate below. Harding was tolerably fluent in French. And Jack, still on deck, said to the master, "Mr. Woodbine, it's time to steer for Keller's Island."
"Yes, sir."
"You don't seem happy, Mr. Woodbine."
"I'm happy about the prize, and I give you joy, sir. But was I in command, I should follow her into Falmouth. The bosun's just going to report that the main yard is probably sprung in the slings, the mizzen doubtful in the welding, the beakhead bulkhead is stove. We've not had an observation these last three watches, and I don't believe the blow has reached its full strength, no, sir, not by a very long chalk. It'll be a great while before Chips and his mates can give us a right wheel, and although steering with sheet and perches is very well for a pleasant Saturday afternoon, it's bloody awkward, pardon me the expression, all night long, in a howling tempest bearing dead on Ushant and its cruel reefs. Imagine trying to avoid a wreck with such a wind and with such a helm. And wrecks there will be by wholesale before daylight." Woodbine had obviously been drinking. "We must do our best," said Jack, not unkindly. Their best they did, but it was not enough. Very late that night, the blow turned out to be one of those notorious turning winds. It headed them when they were no great way from Ushant, and there was no beating into it, even if the Bellona had had a full suit of storm canvas, intact masts, spars and rigging, and a fresh, full-fed crew. She had none of these things. The galley had been flooded in the graveyard watch. It had been all hands right round the clock, and not a man had eaten anything but wet ship's bread since yesterday's dinner. The people were utterly exhausted, and the ship was making more water than the pumps could expel. A certain lightening in the east, and it was first day at last. And they had their bearings, Vega some time before, through the tearing clouds, and old Saturn. The sea, however, was no less, the wind even more contrary. Jack bore up at last and sailed for Corsand Bay. As it expected, there were two other ships from the offshore squadron already there, and one, with only a single lower mast still standing, from the inner. And they'd taken up all the available places. "I am sorry, Aubrey," said the Commissioner, an old friend, "but there it is. However, Alexandria won't take long. It's only a few ribs gone and an ugly hole plugged with a great piece of rock. Wonderful how often that happens, ain't it? Almost makes you believe in guardian angels. And as soon as she's done, you shall have her place. But dear me, Bellona does call for a lot of patching up. So do you yourself, Aubrey. You look dead beat. Believe me, what you want is a hot body bath. The whole body immersed in hot water and kept there for 5 or even 10 minutes. It opens the pores amazingly. They have one at the George and will bring up boiling buckets in a trice. And after that, a thundering good breakfast and sleep for 12 hours. "Certainly, sir," said Jack, "the moment I've written my necessary letter to the Admiral. Fortunately, I have my tender to take it out to Ushant. That pretty little Chesapeake schooner that came in with you, I've been admiring her, not a hair out of place. But, of course, your letter to the Admiral must come first, as you say, and a note to dear Mrs. Aubrey as well, I dare say. Pray remember me very kindly to her." The Commissioner kissed his hand and walked off, chuckling. Jack sat at his table. Bellona, Corsand Bay, November the 17th. "My lord, I beg to acquaint you that His Majesty's ship Bellona suffered much in the severe gale of last night and this morning. The mizzenmast received a violent wrench and is sprung at the partners and elsewhere. The mainyard is also sprung. The mainsail, main topsail, the mizzen and fore storm staysail were blown to pieces. One of the starboard main chain plates drew, and the ship laboured so excessively in the trough of the sea and shipped so much more water than the pumps could carry off that it became absolutely necessary for her safety to bear away for this port, where I arrived in the forenoon. I have the honour to enclose the ship's defects,
and a copy of the log since receiving your last signal. I have the honour to be, my lord, etc. Log of the Bellona.
16th p.m. Strong breeze with heavy swell. Tacked ship as per signal. Lost sight of squadron in heavy and almost continuous squalls. Sighted strange sail in pursuit of British brig southwest by south 2 leagues. Pursued and took same when she proved to be Le Deux Frères of Lorient, privateer frigate of 28 12-pounders and 2 39-pound carronades, 174 men, Dumanoir master. Sent her into Falmouth, a valuable prize having taken 2 homeward-bound Guinea men laden with gold dust and ivory, and an outward-bound snow carrying ship stores to Lisbon. At 10:30, strong gales with heavy squalls. Carried away starboard main brace and larboard main topsail sheet. Sail blew to pieces. Set a storm main and fore staysail. 17th a.m. At 6:30, the storm mizzen and fore staysail blew from the yard. Strong gales veering and backing irregularly. At 8:00, obliged to scuttle lower deck. Ship labouring very much and gained 6 inches on the pumps. At 8:15, the carpenter reported the mizzenmast was sprung in consequence of the vangs of the gaff giving way. At 8:30, was struck with the sea on the larboard quarter. Stove in 11 of the main deck ports. Half filled the main deck and carried away the bulkheads of the wardroom. At 8:00, hard gales with violent squalls. Carried away the chain plate to the foremast main shroud. Bore up under a reefed foresail. Saw a line of battleship lying to with her head to the southward and her sails split and blowing from the yards. John Aubrey. Jack reread his letter. Realised that the two parts didn't exactly coincide, but he was too stupid and heavy to deal with this, so he sanded, folded, addressed and sealed it. He and Harding had already seen to the transfer of the Bellona's hands to receiving ships, and the few officers and midshipmen who didn't cling to what was left of their cabins and berth where they could at least get some sleep had found themselves lodgings. All he had to do now was to carry this letter to Reed or Callow, they alternated aboard the Ringle, and ask for it to be taken out to Ushant. But no sooner was the seal well in place than he clapped his hand to his forehead and whipped the letter open again, adding, "My lord, I am sending you this letter by my tender, but at the present moment I'm so stupid after the night's blow that I forgot to beg that you would be so good as to send her back as soon as you may find convenient. I have, as your lordship knows, a rendezvous at the Dark of the Moon, and if the repairs to Bellona cannot be carried out by then, I should wish to keep the engagement in Ringle. No other craft would serve the purpose." He sealed the letter again, burnt his fingers on the wax, and a certain pettishness at last breaking through, he cried, "Hell, death and damnation!" "Is that you, sir?" asked Harding, looking through the door. "I thought you was fast asleep at the George, gone ashore long ago." "No. I had to write to the Admiral first, and now I must take it to the Ringle to carry across. But then I shall sleep, by God. Sleep like a crew of hedge pigs in an ivy tuft. Then in the afternoon I shall go to Woolcombe for a few days. Urgent family affairs. The yard will not start any important repairs till Monday, and even if they do, you know as much about the barkey's needs as I do. Give me the letter, sir. I'll see to it. The sooner you're abed, the better if you're to make a journey. Sleep, God help us, nothing like it. I shall turn in myself in 20 minutes. Goodbye, sir. Sleep very well, and you'll wake a new man." Jack slept in his bath, slept in his bed at the George until noon, slept in the postchaise that carried him towards Woolcombe at so handsome a pace that it would have been the fastest run he had ever made from Plymouth, but for a linchpin that slipped from its place, liberating the corresponding wheel, which bowled away at a great pace down the road whilst the chaise plunged into a ditch. A harmless plunge into a soft, well-filled ditch. This took place just outside Alton, a village not 5 miles from home. But by the time wheel, horse, baggage and postillion were reassembled and the chaise hoisted upright, it was dark, and Jack decided to spend the night at the Cross Keys, an inn kept by a former boatswain. Here he supped nobly and slept again, a deep, deep sleep, perfectly limp and relaxed until the first dawn woke him. He rose up a new man indeed, not exactly cheerful, but curiously sanguine. The chaise was not ready. The wheel needed a few more hours, but there was a respectable horse, and having snatched an early breakfast, he mounted and set out, the sun just over Alton Hill. Quite what was in his mind as he rode into the stable yard, he hardly recalled. But a first cold, cold shock was the sight of his daughter Charlotte, a leggier child than when last he saw her. She was in the kitchen doorway, staring. Her face expressed no sort of pleasure. She shouted back into the house, presumably to her sister, "It's Papa!" and vanished. George came running out, however, as Jack gave the horse over to Harding, and bade him a perfectly unaffected, friendly, "Good morning, sir, how'd you do?" "And a very good morning to you, George, my dear. Where's your mamma?" "They ain't down yet, sir. I believe they're drinking tea upstairs. But, sir, if only you'd come 5 minutes earlier, you would have seen Cousin Diana's new coach. Oh, such a beauty. She's gone to Lyme with Mrs. Oakes and Bridget. I love them so much." Up the stairs, and they creaking with his weight and haste. The room opened to the east, and the cool morning light fell full on Sophie and her mother as they sat side by side copying letters. Neither had dressed. Sophie had not yet done up her hair. She was wearing the sort of gown that women clutch about their throat. She was not looking at all her best. Yet it was neither a lack of bloom nor of colour that struck him, but rather the presence of some quality he had never seen in her at any time. Both women started, sitting upright from their papers as he came in. Mrs. Williams continued the movement, and clapping a hand to her head, rose up and ran out. She could no more be seen without a cap than without any upper garment at all. "What are you doing here?" asked Sophie, and her voice, like her expression, might have been her mother's. "Bellona's in dock for repairs," said Jack, "and I've come to spend a few days at home." "Not with my good will," she replied. "But above all, I've come to ask your pardon, to say I'm very sorry indeed, and to beg you will forgive me." The door behind Sophie opened a little. "Not with my good will," she repeated mechanically. "I shouldn't have been here, but the Admiral will not leave before his term." She put her hand to a falling swag of hair, and speaking in a hurried voice, she said, "Here, look here, all these are her letters, your mistress's letters. And here is the ring you gave me before God's altar, before God's altar. And you come here to this house." "Oh, Sophie, my dear," he said gently, coming a little nearer and looking her in the face. Mrs. Williams opened the door. He clapped it to and shot the bolt. She could be heard scrabbling the other side. "Oh, come, Sophie," he said again. But she cried out that he should never have come here. It was most improper, most indelicate, and that he must go away at once. Some of this was less than coherent, but there was no mistaking the vehemence of resentment. He fell back and said, "Is that indeed all you have to say to me, Sophie?" "Yes, it is," she cried, "and I never want to see you again." "Then be damned to you for a hard, ill-natured and pitiless, unforgiving shrew," he said, anger rising at last. And he walked out, leaving her, bowed over the miserable letters, utterly appalled by his words and by her own.